Hi, it's Brian Mabry, and this is episode 8 of the Planning and Zoning News Podcast. Follow me on Twitter at Zoning News or follow my blog at zoningnews.tumblr.com. I am an urban planner in Elkhart, Indiana, and this is the podcast where I read news articles related to urban planning and zoning. And that was my childhood friend Chris McFarlane bringing us in with his song On the Wing from his record The Unraveling. I haven't done a podcast in a while, so I hope you all are still with me. Today I'm going to cover an urbanizing Houston suburb, populist urbanism, ways to fail at form-based codes, part 3, new urbanism in El Paso, Texas, and then we'll close with a song by Marty Robbins called El Paso. But first, we have the zoning ordinance rewrite in Los Angeles to read about. This is an article from PlanEdison, and it's called The Challenges of Recoding LA, and it was written by Lee Einsweiler, who was my boss at my first planning job in Austin, Texas. It was posted on November 25th, 2013. The Challenges of Recoding LA. Zoning History. Los Angeles is the second largest city in the U.S., an economic and cultural hub with global significance and home to one of the nation's most outdated and convoluted zoning codes. When the current zoning code for the city was written in 1946, Harry Truman was president, World War II had just ended, and the population of the city was just under 2 million, roughly half of what it is today. The code at that time was a manageable document of 84 pages and was appropriate for the relative simplicity of the city it was responsible for regulating. Over the next 57 years, LA's population more than doubled and now sits at almost 4 million inhabitants living on almost 500 square miles of land. During this period, entire neighborhoods have completely transformed both demographically and physically. The hubs of commerce and activity have shifted multiple times, and residents from 1946 Los Angeles would scarcely recognize the current city. In an attempt to manage the rapidly changing city, public officials tacked on layers of new plans, overlays, and property-specific development limitations to keep up with market trends and community needs. As a result, LA's zoning code grew from 84 pages in 1946 to over 600 pages now. Over 60% of the city's land is covered by special overlays and site-specific designations today. These amendments to a particular parcel of land have become the norm rather than the exception. As a result, development under the zoning code is now a challenging process and routinely confuses developers and planners as well as the general public. A new zoning code. In response, the City of Los Angeles is undertaking a 5-year, $5 million project to completely rewrite the zoning code. See recode.la for additional details. There are numerous goals of the recode project, including improved clarity, procedural streamlining, alignment with the city's plans, attracting investment, and improving the quality of life for all Angelenos. Designed to function as an interactive document, the new code will be easily accessible online by any interested viewer. Rewrite challenges. Any major city seeking to revise land use regulations that are more than a half century old is embarking on a massive undertaking. But for a city that's seeking to evolve its land use and transportation patterns and is as physically and demographically diverse as Los Angeles, a unique set of challenges has emerged. Those listed below are based on our initial visits and do not represent any deep analysis by the consultant team. A critique of the existing regulations, what is working, what is broken, is due out to the public just after the first of the year. Challenge number one, a city of cities. Los Angeles is a city made up of a variety of communities that function almost like cities within a city. Perhaps we should blame the Postal Service for their naming conventions? The land area and population make it an enormous challenge to regulate. There are 95 city-recognized neighborhood groups, 35 separate community plans, making up the land use element of the general plan, and it requires 7 area planning commissions to handle development approvals across the city. Our code drafting mantra has always been the right rules in the right places, and applying this to such a large land area with so many diverse communities will be difficult. reviewing existing plans to determine where the city intends to allow transformative change versus incremental change is a significant task. Replacing existing one-size-fits-all approaches and ensuring that new zoning, especially height and floor area allocations, doesn't entice developers to alter the character of places that the community values will be a constant battle. Maintaining distinct neighborhoods, providing opportunities for leveling the playing field between large-scale development and small landowners, offering opportunities for local entrepreneurs to create their own businesses, all of these will require a fine-grained approach to zoning. And yet, there is a limited timeline for the new zoning. Downtown within 2 years, citywide within 5 years. The team cannot get bogged down in the paralysis of analysis that affects so many plan implementation projects. Challenge number two, matching transit investment. Though Los Angeles is often accused of sprawling, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, the city boasts about 25,000 persons per square mile in the metropolitan area, second among American cities in density to New York City. No matter how today's development pattern is described, the conversion of auto-oriented development into walkable urban centers is desired community-wide. LA is working hard to manage its intense love-hate relationship with the automobile by improving access for cyclists and pedestrians throughout the city. The area's massive investment in public transportation improvements, including continuing improvements funded through Measure R, the West Side Subway Extension, the Expo Line, and the Regional Connector, will change the face of LA once again, concentrating development activity along rail and bus lines extending throughout the city. The opportunity for jobs near housing is strengthened, reducing the need for vehicle miles traveled by commuters. Linking land use to transportation by offering zoning that supports this massive investment is crucial. Underbuilding areas served by transit generates lost opportunities for density and increases pressure on the remainder of the community to accommodate new residents. Challenge number three, plan implementation. California provides a unique model of planning and plan implementation. Los Angeles has a general plan with an embedded framework plan which establishes overall community intensities, 35 community plans which provide local land use, and numerous specific plans which act like planning and zoning combined. This toolkit, enabled by the state, leaves many planners, citizens, and developers confused as to where planning ends and zoning begins. Community plans often contain standards for new development, such as buffers, allowed uses, etc. Specific plans often contain both standards, measurable elements, and guidelines, guidance applied using discretion. This leads to confusion regarding the authority for regulation and lots of legal action, and many of these plans are decades old and perhaps out of date. Even when the community, planners, and developers all agree on the degree of change desired and plan for it, it is difficult to implement with the existing confusing, conflicting regulatory tools. The provision of a usable, accessible, consistent framework for plan implementation must be one of the key outcomes of this zoning rewrite. A toolbox for coding places. Rewriting LA's zoning code will require public input from a wide range of the city's stakeholders, including residents, property owners, businesses, and even developers. Finding common ground and developing a zoning code that reflects the needs of the diverse array of Angelenos presents a challenge, but also highlights the strengths of the city. In the end, new zoning for LA must take the form of a planner's toolbox for creating great places, supporting transit, and solidifying the quality of life across the city's neighborhoods. When I read about all the general plans and specific plans and area plans and how planning language often looks like zoning and code language, I'm reminded of Florida, and Florida functions that way, similar to that way as well, where you'll be reading a comprehensive plan for a Florida city or county, and you'll have language in it that's very much reads like zoning ordinance language. Also, this task, I'm sure, is just very daunting for the consultant team. I know that I'm working on the zoning ordinance for a very rather small and relatively simple Indiana county, and it has its own big challenges as well. So trying to do Los Angeles's code is mind-blowing, to say the least. Our second article is from the HoustonChronicle.com website, and The title is The Woodlands New Urban Face Challenges Suburban Feel. And it was written by Mike Tolson, and it was posted September 2nd, 2013. The downtown street scene was typically subdued for a weeknight in Houston's endless summer, with a few couples strolling past the shop windows, groups of teenage girls giggling over a shared joke as they cupped freshly made smoothies, and a handful of kids romping across the grassy oval area that sits at the heart of the town square. This was urban life in its most idealized form, stripped of homeless panhandlers, belching buses, obnoxious drunks, and ever-present police officers keeping an eye out for potential trouble. The streets were clean and the sidewalks free of litter. No sacks of garbage sat waiting for the late-night pickup, and nary a bad smell was to be found anywhere. Horns went unhonked, voices unraised. Dog days or not, could this really be downtown Houston? Not exactly. It's a downtown near Houston, but not exactly of Houston. For one thing, most of the people one encounters are white, in contrast to the racially and ethnically diverse area to the south. For another, the surrounding mix of architecture is recently built and essentially a facade, much like a Hollywood set. And the shops all boast high-end luxury names: Tommy Bahama, Michael Kors, Tiffany, Sur La Table. No dowdy convenience store or greasy chicken shack here. Since its early days, the Woodlands has been Woodlands, with homes nestled between countless trees and an overall setting that looks more like a park than a subdivision. But today, well into its fifth decade, it's more urban life without the grit, funkiness, aggravation, and fear. Whether the Woodlands appeal could end up providing as much curse as blessing is a question that will become more relevant as growth and development continues nearby. ExxonMobil is building a sprawling 385-acre campus just to the south, which will be home to an estimated 10,000 employees. New housing subdivisions are popping up regularly to the east, west, and north. Traffic will become an increasing challenge. Already an expanded FM 1488 could use more expansion, and it may in time resemble the torturous stop-and-start strip of FM 1960. FM is Farm Road, Farm-to-Market Road in Texas, which is sort of like a state-run county road. Restaurants and shops will be more crowded, as well as parking lots and schools. For now, those who live in the Woodlands like that it's a world unto itself. Whenever we leave and come back, we joke about being back in the bubble, said Stephanie John, who has lived there since 2001. It's really nice to have all the green around us, to feel like we're back home in a special place. We really don't have to leave it for much of anything. My husband says when he drives as far south as FM 1960, he feels like he's gone downtown. Both work in the Woodlands, she for an oil and gas exploration company, and husband Charles for a regional power company. They were attracted by the sheer beauty of the place, and the good schools and lack of serious crime made their choice easy when they relocated from New Orleans in 2001. I'm more likely to have a deer come out and surprise me than a mugger, John said. Established along principles that were decidedly non-Texan at the time, the de facto city that is run like a business has matured much along the lines imagined by its founder, George Mitchell, who lived long enough to see his new style of suburb reach maturity. His 28,000-acre island has come to serve as a model for how to build a master-planned community, a place to live and work, and its satisfying mix of urban and pastoral. Its guiding ethos seemed almost as novel as it did when Mitchell assembled a team of planners, builders, environmentalists, and told them to build a city that treated the natural world as its greatest asset. Noted Houston environmental lawyer Jim Blackburn worked there as a young consultant before starting his legal practice. Mitchell was doing something that had never been done, build a new community based on environmental principles, Blackburn said. I believe the experiment was successful. It was a very different place than it was in its natural condition, of course, but compared to other communities, it was light years ahead. Mitchell set aside about 1,000 acres near Interstate 45 to serve as the downtown town center in Woodland speak, and watched it sit mostly undisturbed for years. He dreamed of office towers and corporate headquarters mixed in with higher density residential developments and pedestrian-friendly retail and entertainment corridors. It was a far cry from the typical bedroom community. Many traditional developers lived by a simple credo: get in, get out, get rich. For decades, the mega development stood out not only for its good taste, but its isolation, well north of competing suburbs and subdivisions. No more. Its population doubled between 2000 and 2011 and now sits at approximately 106,000. The residential areas are getting close to built out, which means future population growth will come in or near the high-density town center. The maximum population estimate is about 130,000, but it could go higher. In time, residents of the Woodlands might need for their hometown to become a full-fledged city with ordinance-making powers along with its own public safety and public works departments. For the time being, surveys say they are satisfied with the current unique township form of government, which is a hybrid between a private corporation and elected municipal government. But for how long? Bruce Tuff, a chairman for the board of directors for the Woodlands Township, said there is no rush to become a city because the combination of contracted services and municipal utility districts yield a more efficient operation than any town or city can boast, and taxes would surely go up, he said. Efficiency won't mean much, however, if infrastructure demands outpace construction, or if more people begin to chafe under the rules conceived not by elected council members, but homeowner associations. People love the Woodlands, but increasingly they are not wanting to live by our rules, he said. You cannot continue to regulate the behavior of 130,000 people by covenant enforcement. We're becoming a big city, and we are getting big city issues. Within the boundaries of the Woodlands, a building is not simply thrown up only to find the nearby parking is not adequate. But outside those boundaries, the planning is negligible and the development patterns are typical Texas hodgepodge. The Woodlands will continue to be a success story by most standards, but as one parcel of vacant land after another near it is gobbled up, life outside the bubble could get increasingly difficult, and eventually, just maybe, the bubble itself may be in for challenging times. Unplanned development becomes unsightly, and it creates safety and mobility issues, Tuff said. What if Montgomery County does not have capacity to keep up with it? You have to look at it in the big picture. You can no longer look at it as a single entity, the Woodlands in a silo. Our third article is from bettercities.net, and it's entitled Populist Urbanism Beyond the Creative Class. And it was posted on November 6, 2013, and the author is Robert Studeville. A couple of recent stories on better cities and towns points to an ongoing problem. New urbanism, smart growth, and related trends need to work on their appeal to working class and minority groups. That may be the only reason why Roxanne Qualls, mayor of Cincinnati in the 1990s, came far short on her bid to be elected again. Qualls built her campaign around support of the city's streetcar. Qualls argued the streetcar is a key to economic growth in Cincinnati and that it will attract young, talented workers and connect the high employment districts in the city. The $133 million streetcar has already begun construction with the aid of $44.9 million in federal grants. Mayor-elect John Cranley, Qualls' opponent, promised to cancel the project. Qualls is right, the streetcar could be good for Cincinnati. Canceling it will cost the city a pile of money and slow redevelopment of up-and-coming neighborhoods. Yet this position did not interest most voters. Minority voters mostly stayed home, even though the city's African-American Chamber of Commerce endorsed Qualls. The working-class neighborhoods went for Cranley. Qualls won downtown and adjacent neighborhoods, but that only added up to 42% of the vote. Qualls' position of moving toward transportation choice was less appealing than Cranley's emphasis on building a highway interchange and cutting other expenses. Many longtime citizens in the Queen City did not connect with the idea of fostering urban life through a walkable, transit-oriented city in this election. A blog written by Jay Waljasper reports on the difficulty that bicycle planning often runs into in African-American neighborhoods. Some residents even associate highly visible street changes like bike lanes with the displacement of long-time black residents in favor of younger, often white, newcomers, he writes. Waljasper offers tips for active transportation planners to speak to residents in less affluent minority neighborhoods. Working-class families in general, and minorities in particular, often benefit from planning that strengthens freedom in transportation. Many working-class families spend more on transportation than they do on housing. Catherine Lutz and Ann Lutz Fernandez, authors of the 2009 book Carjacked, report on the burden of automobile expenses on the less well-off. If the costs of cars for middle-class families have become largely insurmountable, those costs are immediately and profoundly crushing for working and poor families, they write. Alternatives to the automobile in neighborhoods that are truly car optional are empowering, therefore, to the poor and to the working class. If a family is able, through choice of neighborhood, to avoid spending 20% or 30% of its income on car expenses, what can that family do instead? Enjoy life more? Pay tuition so a member can go to college? Save a little for a rainy day? The possibilities are many. As the popularity of urban living grows, many neighborhoods in big cities have surged in value, displacing residents. However, studies also show that neighborhoods with no revitalization have higher displacement because lack of opportunity and crime cause many more residents to leave. I make a distinction, therefore, between revitalization that is desirable and necessary to avoid economic collapse and gentrification, where the truly rich arrive, that prices out the working class poor. Meanwhile, the young, educated, creative class is flocking to many downtowns and generating a degree of resentment among long-term residents. Millennials bring energy and vitality to cities as they struggle up the ladder of success, yet they are nevertheless sometimes dismissed as unserious hipsters. It probably doesn't help that urbanists are always talking about how the creative class will revitalize cities. That claim is true, but urbanists should also emphasize how cities, especially car-optional cities, empower people of all classes. By overemphasizing one demographic group, we send the message that other groups are not included in the urban renaissance. One answer could be lean urbanism, an emergent set of ideas that are aligned with new urbanism. Lean urbanism is an answer, in a way, to gentrification. Millennials, immigrants, and people who work with their hands, also known as self-builders, have something in common, according to urban planner Andreas Dewani. They often don't have the capital to get things done in today's heavily regulated urban places. Lean urbanism is all about lighter, quicker, cheaper ways to revitalize cities and towns. It's about streamlined codes and small-scale development that doesn't require elevators and parking garages. Recently in Detroit, I had an extended conversation with a bartender, a squat, bearded guy of about 30 whose name I never did learn. He and his wife are raising their 2-year-old son in East Detroit, where you can buy a house for $5,000. He has personally fixed up 3 or 4 houses and rents them out. He and his wife also run a tea shop while he holds down the job tending bar. He is not afraid to walk down most streets of Detroit, and the downtown has gotten a lot more livable in recent years despite the city's bankruptcy. This guy is practicing lean urbanism. Urbanists ought to be reaching out to people like him and to everyone who is struggling to make things better in every city in America. We have to make the pitch that the city is not just for educated, mostly white, young professionals. There's room and jobs and community enough for everyone in today's resurgent cities. New urbanism is about safety and jobs and livability and freedom. That's transportation choice for everyone. Why can't smart growth adopt a more populist message? I don't have all the answers as to how that could happen, yet advocates for walkable cities could lay the groundwork for our political leaders to run on a positive message of urban transformation. Our fourth article comes from placemakers.com, and it's the third article in a series called Ways to Fail at Form-Based Codes. And this third article is called Misapply the Transect to the Region Rather than the Neighborhood. And it is written by Hazel Borries, and it was posted on May 2nd, 2013. When it comes to misapplying, or more commonly, overly simplifying the transect, we're all guilty on some level. For instance, I often speak generally about its inherent rural-to-urban spectrum and how, as you move through it, the landscape changes its character. The highways and byways whisking you through the wilderness and countryside get increasingly slower as you approach the city center, becoming streets of very specific proportions. Buildings change too, sitting on their lots in much more formal fashion as you move to the core, with trees and sidewalks dutifully matching the rhythms of their formality. This may lead you to believe that the transect is like a fried egg, with the most urban T6 in the middle slowly fanning out to the wilderness T1 along the edge. This sort of Jetson-like city is the transect misapplied. Unlike a rainbow, where the colors of the spectrum remain faithfully at each other's side, the transect, well applied, appears as neighborhood nodes connecting across the land at a very fine grain. and when different urban intensities interact, like where Central Park's Civic, similar to T1, that's Manhattan's T4, T5, and T6, deeply satisfying environments emerge. A fried egg T6, where you have to go a long way to a wilderness T1, doesn't enhance well-being and severely hampers free-range kids. The transect is fractal to some extent, having a regional scale, neighborhood scale, and even a lot scale from the front to the back of the house. You can arrange almost anything based on what you do or wear or see in T1 versus what's appropriate for T6. No tuxedo at the square dance, please. This fractal nature of the transect is a nested series of coherent levels, so when the transect zones are correctly applied, they are done at the neighborhood scale, not at the regional scale. Although each transect zone has some degree of mixed use, the transect misapplied will give too much homogeneity, the very thing that form-based codes seek to repair. Then a Jetsons-like application will still require a rocket ship to get from T6 to T1 in 5 minutes, and disable the possibility of walking to the majority of your daily needs should you choose to live in the T3 suburban zone. It's true that our transect illustrations often reinforce this idea of the regional transect, although their primary objective is to illustrate the change in character in the different zones and not to imply that they cover the region. To thwart this easy-to-make mistake, the following graphic shows different smart code community unit types for new communities: clustered land development, traditional neighborhood development, and regional center development, and the transect zones which they are comprised. The Ranson Sector Plan, below, is the primary policy tool in the urban growth boundary for guiding future growth. Instead of allowing pods of separate land uses, the sector plan enables for complete communities, compact, pedestrian-oriented, mixed-use neighborhoods, as well as identifying areas to remain suburban for the near term. However, you'll note that transect zones aren't mapped to the region in the comprehensive plan, but rather to the neighborhood in the zoning code. Note that the preferred growth and controlled growth areas to the north end of the map have to do with the soon-to-be-relocated Duffield's train station that's moving from the middle of a field to a more accessible location. If you want to rewind and learn about the transect theory and the environmental roots of the idea, visit the Center for Applied Transect Studies website and Facebook page. If you want to delve further into the subject, check out this 3-hour conversation from CNU 20, The Misunderstood Transect, particularly starting at 54 minutes and 51 seconds with Sandy Sorline, Andre Stewani, Emily Tallon, and others. With 2013 being the 50th anniversary of the Jetsons, I'd say we haven't quite reached their elevated projections of a mechanized world. Instead, we've returned to a placemaking aesthetic where we can cast a shadow, walk a mile, and cycle our way back to fitness and reconnection, and hopefully by doing so, learn to conserve enough to be able to afford a machine or two for our grandchildren. And our final article is from governing.com, and it's called El Paso Teaches New Urbanism to Architects, Engineers, and it was written by Todd Newcomb, and it was posted October 2nd, 2013. For more than 50 years, developers and city officials in El Paso, Texas, worked from the same page when it came to designing and improving new commercial, institutional, and residential developments. New buildings tended to be low-slung, sprawling complexes designed to meet the needs of the automobile and not the city's residents. Every commercial building was surrounded by parking lots and kept firmly separate from residential areas, the two linked only by roads and highways. But that's changing. El Paso officials want to reinvent the city by following the tenets of new urbanism, which means a greater emphasis on dense, walkable neighborhoods, mixed-use buildings that are street-oriented, and more green spaces. But there was one big problem in making that change. The local development community and the architects were still designing the old-fashioned way. A sort of tug-of-war developed between the two. The city rejected more and more projects, while the development community pushed back, complaining that city officials weren't doing a good job communicating what it was they wanted. That's when El Paso's city manager Joyce Wilson finally turned, exasperated, to her development director Matthew McElroy and asked, "How do we get to a place where everybody gets this?" The answer, develop a training program for both public officials and the private sector on new urbanism. McElroy had already taken an accreditation course from the Congress for New Urbanism, an organization that promotes mixed use and sustainable neighborhood development. The course, which was developed in partnership with the University of Miami, teaches the core principles of new urbanism, including the common language and best practices of urbanism, according to Abigail Buzon Colestian, CNU's administration and finance director. El Paso ended up offering a 9-week session on new urbanism to its department heads and engineers, and has since opened the course up to the private sector. The city has also started requiring that any design firm that wants to do capital work with the city has to have someone on the team accredited in new urbanism practices. According to McElroy, approximately 100 city staff and 100 private architects and engineers have taken the course and passed the accreditation exam. Today, El Paso is fielding multiple requests from other cities to come and teach new urbanism, says McElroy, who plans to run a 3-day intensive session in Austin soon. And in January, McElroy will run a similar scenario for 40 to 50 government workers in Oklahoma City. CNU isn't the only organization offering courses on new urbanism. There's the National Charette Institute, which teaches project managers how to run a collaborative public designing process that incorporates sustainability, regional planning, and transportation planning. Director Bill Lannertz describes the program as a delivery system for urban planners and designers who want to break away from today's suburban sprawl approach to planning. Another organization, known as the Placemakers, offers online discussions, webinars, and training around new urbanism for urban designers, architects, civic boosters, enviros, developers, politicos, city staffers, preservationists, and community activists. The accreditation program that is run by CNU, like new urbanism itself, is relatively new. Besides teaching about the language and best practices, the course covers everything from the main principles of new urbanism to the details of street design that incorporate complete, sustainable streets, according to Buzon Colestian. She described the program as scalable, so it can handle the training needs of small, medium, and large cities. For El Paso, the impact of new urbanism training has been dramatic. Where once the development and architectural community just didn't get it, according to McElroy, it now really pushes the quality of design quite a bit. Design quality has become the focus for not just better designed corner street stores, but also for a number of large-scale projects the city is funding, including a new museum, arena, ballpark, cultural center, and parks. The result, says McElroy, is that new urbanism concepts have become institutionalized. El Paso now has a design review commission, something that wouldn't have existed a few years ago. Design has become such a focal point, he says. And that article concludes our podcast, episode number 8 of the Planning and Zoning News podcast. Again, you can follow me on Twitter at Zoning News or follow my blog at zoningnews.tumblr.com. And we'll close this episode with the song El Paso, which is sung by Marty Robbins. It became sort of famous recently as one of the main key songs in the final episode of the television series Breaking Bad. And so we close with one of my dad's favorite singers of all time, which was Marty Robbins singing El Paso. Thanks. Have a good day. Bye.
Out in the West Texas town of El Paso, I fell in love with a Mexican girl. Nighttime would find me in Rose's Cantina, music would play and Felina would whirl. Blacker than night were the eyes of Felina, wicked and evil while casting a spell. My love was deep for this Mexican maiden, I was in love but in vain I could tell. One night a wild young cowboy came in, wild as the West Texas wind. Dashing and daring a dream. drink he was sharing with wicked Felina, the girl that I love. So in anger I challenged his right for the love of this maiden. Down went his hand for the gun that he wore. My challenge was answered in less than a heartbeat. A handsome young stranger lay dead on the floor. Just for a moment I stood there in silence, shocked by the foul evil deed I had done. Many thoughts raced through my mind as I stood there. I had but one chance, and that was to run. Out through the back door of roses I ran, out where the horses were tied. I caught a good one, it looked like it could run. Up on its back and away I did ride, just as fast as I could, from the West Texas town of El Paso out to the badlands of New Mexico. Back in El Paso, my life would be worthless. Everything's gone in life, nothing is left. It's been so long since I've seen the young maid. My love is stronger than my fear of death. I saddled up and away I did go, riding alone in the dark. Tonight nothing's worse than this pain in my heart. And at last here I am on the hill overlooking El Paso. I can see Rosa's cantina below. My love is strong and it pushes me onward. Down off the hill to Felina I go. Off to my right I see five mounted cowboys, off to my left right a dozen or more. Shouting and shooting, I can't let them catch me. I have to make it to Rose's back door. Something is dreadfully wrong, for I feel a deep burning pain in my soul. I'm getting weary, unable to ride. But my love for the leader is strong, and I rise where I've fallen. Though I am weary, I can't stop to rest. I see the white puff of smoke from the rifle. I feel the bullet go deep in my chest. Out of nowhere, Felina has found me, kissing my cheek as she kneels by my side. Cradled by two loving arms that I'll die for, one little kiss and Felina.